This is St. Pete X, affectionately known as SPX. SPX brings you St. Pete's brightest business people, civic leaders, and citizens who share their insight and expertise as well as their love of our great city. SPX is presented by the St. Petersburg Group. Head to stpete.co to check out more episodes, and by St. Pete's most effective marketing agency, Big C. Browse to bigc.co to see their work. Now enjoy the conversation.
Are you recording?
I'm recording.
He's okay. Recording since I told him he had a circulation of 5.
We shouldn't.
Let's start with which.
You shouldn't laugh at yourself.
It's funny. We kind of do have a circulation of 5. I don't mind saying that. We come from humble roots. Yeah, we are salt of the earth, growing St. Pete Business News. One listener, one reader by reader.
I will
run out of relatives soon, but.
You use the word magnate.
Yeah.
Magnate. Yeah, it's all in his mind.
What is that? Let's look up delusions of grandeur.
No, I was relating a funny story. I went to a lovely event at the Dali with I believe you were technically the host. Johns Hopkins was technically the host, and got to meet Ian Anderson from the business room the first time. And
not from Jethro Tull, no flutes.
And he joined us for dinner, which was lovely. And so we sort of had a little fun with him.
Walter
Balzer was there. Yep. Jim Resti, the whole open crew was there, and Irv Cohen. So it was three SPG members, which was nice. And so we had a little fun with Ian, and Paul Tash was there as well. So I said that Ian had to join me for a picture with Paul to make sure that all the publishing magnates in St. Pete got in one frame, historic moment.
And then Dr. Ellen was looking for a definition of magnate.
And that's 5 or more readers.
And then he was using his one hand. The digits on one hand to have that conversation.
All right, I'm just going to take a deep breath and get through this title. President, CEO, and Physician-in-Chief of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital and Vice Dean and Professor of Pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
To what do we owe the honor?
We've stepped up a little here in our...
You guys, first of all, fixed your technology. So that's a really... Okay, it's an improvement. That's why I'm here.
In full transparency, here, second time around, we had an interview with Dr. Ellen a couple weeks ago. That went a little bit rogue. Our technology failed us, but it was a brilliant interview. We're hoping to resurrect some of that brilliance in round 2. Do you feel up for it?
No, not at all, but we'll go for it anyway.
Your arms are crossed.
I know the body language is here.
No, there's nowhere to stick my arms, and my belly's my best place. So that's
here. Makes a good cup holder. I've done that before.
I could lean back and you wouldn't hear me, right? Unless I do this.
Get comfortable. So when we introduced you the first time around, I asked you, what is it that you don't do? And you said you don't currently practice, but you used to.
No, I do practice. 2 weeks a year, I supervise residents taking care of patients. I usually do it at the end of the year because by then they're really autonomous and good docs, and so then I really can't screw up too much. So I come in at the end. What I don't do is research. That's the thing that I used to do. I mean, I started doing research in about 1985, looking at doing research on HIV and HIV/AIDS. In 85, and I didn't stop until probably about 2015, but I don't do research anymore.
Pediatrics is your background?
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into that? Wait, let me ask that. So how did you get into that?
You have
an interesting family dynamic in terms of your
parents. Right, exactly.
Practice.
Oh, see, you remember from the last interview. There you learn. My father was an obstetrician gynecologist. My mother was a social worker. So by definition, you become an adolescent medicine provider. So I was a pediatrician trained to take care of children, 0 to basically 18, 20, 21, 22. And in the process, I became very interested in social determinants and social factors that shaped health. And so I knew I was going to do that. And then I started looking at different post-residency opportunities for training. And the one I fell in love with had to do with decision-making that teenagers made. And why would a teenager make a high-risk decision? So the place to go for that turned out to be in San Francisco. So I moved out to San Francisco in 91. And then when I got there, the people were also really engaged in HIV, as you can imagine, because it was the height of the epidemic going on, and San Francisco being an epicenter for that epidemic. Most of the social scientists, behavioral scientists, were being funded to do work in HIV. So I ended up getting trained by all the behavioral scientists and mental health scientists on how to study social and behavioral factors that associated with the transmission and acquisition of HIV and then other sexually transmitted infections. And then when I started doing that, I got involved with epidemiology. So I ended up in the end of this all being a social epidemiologist studying STDs and HIV. And that's what I did until 2015.
So all of that to me has a large, because you're studying the sort of what happens when, but there has to be some facet of that is how do we cause when, which is sort of a PR / marketing element that says we know that this is how things spread, or this is the kind of information that people receive, the inputs they receive. How much of your work was put into controlling that messaging?
I ended up rejecting that whole approach. I was not a big believer, particularly with teenagers, that you could change behavior easily. What I really believed was that we could intervene on factors that were happening in the community that set up the determinants of transmission. So half of my work was studying things like how people chose their sex partners, how much geography affected where you chose your sex partners from, how much the nature of the people who live in your community shaped a sex network. And I did a lot of network mapping and all that kind of work. And then when you have that context, you say, okay, what affects that? So it's kind of a root cause. And we went back to saying, well, there are policies and practices and programs in communities and around the city that shape what happens. So whether it's the incarceration process that then changes the male-female balance in a community, whether it's the fact that you have young women, you know, in an impoverished community, you can have very well-intentioned, I'll say church-going families living next to high-risk, either they could be anything from, if you want to say, sort of drug dealers to even, you know, I don't know the word if it's still relevant, but the concept of a gangbanger, drive-by shootings. So you can imagine, if you think of a drive-by shooting, you could be an innocent kid walking to school and get shot. Well, the same thing happens to innocent adolescents, sometimes living in certain communities. So that whole concept of the community being a risk factor and that it's not the people as much as the context.
So you're looking at delinquency and...
Well, we looked at things like trying to figure out how to keep kids in school. I mean, things at that
level. So you didn't see examples of ways people could actually change context from a informational standpoint, like the Truth Campaign with smoking or something along those lines?
The Truth Campaign, there's two reasons it not. One is the sustainability of those messages. The Truth Campaign's been going on since the tobacco settlement. And there was a lot of money in that tobacco settlement, and it was a long-term kind of commitment that the settlement had. For most, take sexual health issues. There's not long-term funding. I mean, every 3 years, every 4 years, depending on who's president, everything changes. You know, I mean, they can gut CDC. I mean, it's been getting gutted over and over again, and their job was to stop the spread of syphilis. And our syphilis rates are higher than they've ever been almost. And the reason is because we gutted the public health departments. And so the concept that we have sustained action around, you know, something that could be, that is stigmatized, is not something I count on. So could we change social norms? Do we change social norms is a whole much bigger question, but it doesn't happen in over, you know, Just Say No is not a campaign that worked very effectively on the drugs. And that was a very short-lived burst approach, and I don't think it works.
Do you think that the shift in focus, one of the most recent STDs to come under scrutiny is HPV. Do you think that has to do with the same social constructs?
I mean, the HPV thing is a perfect example. I mean, if you think about the reason we care about HPV is because it is the cause of cervical cancer, period, end of story. You don't get cervical cancer with that HPV. And we developed a vaccine for two of the four high-risk types. And they could probably develop a vaccine for more high-risk types.
Is it not detectable in men?
No, it is.
It is.
And now they inoculate men for it too, or vaccinate men. It's harder to test in men. It's just, you don't normally go around swabbing men. We do a lot of pap smears on women. And we actually don't do as many as we used to do. But the concept was that HPV was demonstrated to be the cause of cervical cancer. It can also cause throat cancer. So the answer is get a vaccine that builds the immune system to protect against the development of cancer or the development of the HPV. Turns out everybody who's ever had intercourse has probably gotten HPV. I mean, the prevalence of HPV, it's so prevalent that it's not even worth talking about. But the vaccine stops the acquisition of two of the high-risk types because not all the types cause cancer. the ability to get that into, you'd want to get it into, we didn't want to put another one for babies. So we said, okay, we'll put it into 12-year-olds. They're, most 12-year-olds have not had sex. It's a great age to do it. And there's already a routine visit for your tetanus boosters and several things going on at 12 and school physicals. So why not put it there? Well, the uptake of that vaccine is like 30%. And the reason that people aren't getting it is because the question is, you think my child is having sex? No, but they will eventually. And that whole storyline keeps people from vaccinating their kids. So, I mean, there's always the autism people too. But in terms of even people who are not about the sort of the myths of autism being related to vaccines, there's still a lot of people that just don't do it because they're like, my kid doesn't have sex.
So then taking that, you know, assuming that.
Is that why you brought me here, by the way, to talk about sex? Because I can do it forever
if you want to keep going.
Did you bring a vaccine with you? Can you administer it on site?
No. I could. I know how to.
I'm worried about our five readers.
Press pause.
I need to. So taking this example further, you said that context changing messaging and whatnot doesn't work here. So what does work? What's your best hope of increasing the
30%? Is it not just access to contraceptives? It's a bigger issue than that.
Well, different questions. Okay. So access, in places where there's high access, we still have plenty of disease. So it's policies around access. It's policies around testing and treatment. It's policies around safe neighborhoods. It's policies around schools. It's all these different policies. What's been shown to be effective? I think the most important thing is getting communities mobilized around caring about kids, period. And all these things that I'm talking about require that communities care about teenagers. And a lot of communities have written them off. So, I mean, a lot of people write off teenagers in general.
Yeah, you can get a lot of attention for the younger school age. But once you get into middle school teen, there's a little bit of a drop off in attention and sentiment.
They're not as cute anymore.
Right. Little punks roving around. Well, it's interesting, though. It's just for context, your fervent involvement in HIV, because it was sort of I don't want to call it flash in the pan, but it was the attention around it was pretty poignant. And you saw it in media, you saw it in movies being made, and you saw it in, it was just part of the rhetoric. And for whatever reason, it started to trail off.
Well, white gay men got cured. Black gay men are dying. So the epidemic is still alive and kicking.
Just not as talked about.
Not two reasons. One is the death rates dropped dramatically because we have medications now that are long-term effective in preventing the destruction of the immune system. So even though the virus we keep the virus to almost undetectable levels. If you take the medicines all the time and you keep your virus down, your immune system will stay intact and you won't die. It's become a chronic disease for that. The two things that are, unfortunately, we're still having people get infected. And that's predominantly among Black gay men. And so again, another disenfranchised population, as you can probably guess. So that's why if you watch enough movies, you'll see it in the subtext, but it's not, you're not going to see Angels in America again. You're not going to see.
Or Tom Hanks. What's the Tom Hanks movie?
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, yeah,
right. Yeah. So it keeps bringing me back to information, I guess. This is the world that I live in. So you know this, you know that the disenfranchised Black gay men are at higher risk. Who do you give this information to? Who are you looking to empower with this information and partner with to help make the changes to fix this?
Their community. I mean, you'll put Band-Aids on it, and the Band-Aids will make the curve slow down. But eventually, the question becomes whether the actual, like, there's the big thing right now for prevention is PrEP. It's pre-exposure prophylaxis. So they found that if you regularly took a small amount of antiviral medicine on a regular every day, you will not get infected. So it's kind of like it's pre-exposure prophylaxis. And in fact, in a lot of places, if you know you're going to go out that night and hook up, if you start taking it a couple of days before, and it's pretty damn effective if you take it like you're supposed to take it. That therapy, the uptake of that therapy in the Black gay community is very limited as well. So the question becomes, what do we need to do to get there? And again, it's how you mobilize any community. I'm not an expert in mobilizing in that community. I'm much more an expert in understanding how they're getting infected and why they're getting infected as an epidemiologist more than anything else.
Well, there are some communities that have not been fostered to care about consequences to the same degree. And we had a conversation with a mayoral electoral candidate, and he was talking about car theft. And he was, you know, in some of the work that we've been doing around, you know, sort of circumventing that behavior. But when you get into the mind of a teen who's, you know, looking to get into some trouble or have a fun Saturday night, they're just not, even if they do get incarcerated, they'll be out just as quickly as they got in. And it's just the processing of what's the worst that could happen doesn't happen.
Well, they're not wrong in their process. I mean, that was the thing when I first started doing work with teenagers, and I had a grant for like 15 years from the NIH to study teenagers' decision-making. And the question was, are they irrational? Well, if you know you could steal the car,
right,
and you're going to get released within 24 hours of having stolen the car,
game on.
There are no consequences. Right. So you could sit here and do all the messaging you want. There's no consequence. Now, they are trying to get empathy. I mean, that's their next pitch, right, is to try to create empathy, that there's a consequence, maybe not to you, but to the people whose cars get stolen, and they're trying to create that empathy.
That's interesting.
That's what I think they're doing. I think that's the next step in this thing, is to try to create empathy.
So are you focusing on...
Not me.
So that
I'm not doing that too.
So that consequential piece, though, does it work with STD issues?
Well, that was actually the big question, is that when we got to... A study showed that if you take your medicine every day, if we're a couple and we don't use condoms and you have HIV and I don't, and you take your medicines every day, I will not get infected. But the point of the story was that there was an altruism that's built into that kind of approach, just like there is by, if you know you can take your meds every day, get yourself so you're not virally, you are completely suppressed, and therefore the likelihood of transmission is almost nil. That is a altruistic gesture if it's not just about your own health. And that idea of secondary prevention of secondary transmission is one of the strategies that we've tried over the years. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
So with the gay Black men, are they aware that they are infected or are they unaware in your group that you're studying in terms of that epidemic? Because I'm thinking more about their processing of consequences.
Well, I think in most cases what you find is, so there's a thing called the cascade now. And the cascade says, how many people know what their status is? How many people have been tested? How many people know what their status is? I mean, they went back for the test. How many people who are positive got linked with care? How many people got linked with care, took their meds? How many people took their meds or actually suppressed, right? So that gets down. And you'd like it to stay at 100%, right? Right across. But it drops down to about 15% when you get to the end of the cascade. And it probably, the number who get tested is only about 70%, 65%. And I bet you 5% of, or 10% of those don't go back. So you're probably about 50% of the people who are infected know they're infected.
So can we talk about opiate addiction?
Why not? Because
Happy Monday.
Thank you.
At least we can have fun doing this.
You can't. I mean, it's just a tension reliever. But
sure.
I mean, so Johns Hopkins was recently the beneficiary of an anonymous gift for children who were born of opiate addicted mothers. And it's certainly been on the tip of some of our guests' tongue. We talked to a foundation a couple months back, and he had to predict sort of where the funding would go for nonprofits over the next probably 5 to 10 years. And opioid addiction was an area that he defined from a regional foundation's perspective. So talk about your work there and what you're learning about that issue.
My involvement with the topic goes back, well, first of all, when I was a resident, we took care of drug addicted babies. When I was a resident, it was crack. It wasn't as much opiates at the time. They hadn't pushed oxycodone as far as they pushed it today, but it was crack at the time because it was cheap. And we learned how to take care of those kids came out. We had two issues that always arose with those kids. One was the physical consequences of being addicted and exposed. And then the social consequences of having a mother at the very least who has been using. So there's always that connection of those two. When I got to Baltimore, and Baltimore was probably one of the stronger heroin towns. I don't know why, but it seemed to be really big into heroin. By the time they had set up a program, by the time I moved out to Bayview, which is where I went for my first chairmanship, they had already established a program called the Center for Addicted Parents, and called the CAP program. And it was a program run by pediatrics, OBGYN, and psychiatry. And psychiatry did the addiction work. And we took care of the kids. And one of the investigators and one of the faculty members in that group studied opiate-addicted babies and was trying to figure out which drugs to give the babies, because the way you treat a baby when they're addicted is when they're born, you either give them methadone or something where you actually help them wean off or detox, just like you would anybody else. That doesn't change if they've had either physical consequences in utero that are permanent or potentially
cognitive too, right?
Yeah, if anything affects the brain development at that stage, and then also the social factors, but at least you can stop the addiction. So we started studying different drugs, methadone versus buprenorphine at the time. Fast forward, I come here, and one of the first really public health approaches to opiates that's going on, this is before the, all the studies were coming out that were telling us what was going on, particularly in Sarasota at the time, there was a big push for helping opiate-addicted children and getting treatment and wraparound services for the children and to some degree the parents. When, since we've been here, a lot of the work has been focused on not only how you treat them and what treatment the family needs, but where you treat them and how long you treat them. There is a protocol for treating opiate-addicted babies, and that protocol has gotten tightened up, and I think we do a much better job at all our sites in treating those babies in a very standardized and a much more protocolized way. But also the concept that we could actually have babies go home and receive their methadone at home rather than sitting in a hospital day after day after day after day, separated from the mother if there's a good relationship there. So that's really the kind of work we're doing. Also now dealing with the mom's addiction as part of it is kind of the whole wraparound approach that we've taken. So they're just one of the casualties of the oxycodone world. Like I said earlier on, it was heroin, but now it's predominantly probably oxycodone. Well, anything uplifting you want to talk about?
It's interesting.
It was Easter.
Yeah.
This is probably going to air.
How many eggs did you find?
None.
So just on the same realm of
uplifting stories?
Uplifting stories. Well, maybe just the commitment to community health issues that we're dealing with. And this will have already aired, but tomorrow you are part of an event with some big players. You've got Randy Russell of the Foundation for Healthy St. Petersburg. You've got Michael Grego with the Pinellas County School Board.
Oh, they're both going to be there.
They're both going to be there.
Oh, that would be nice.
I think we have Kanika Tomlin representing the city of St. Petersburg. Other nonprofits will be present. And this is an opportunity to really emphasize the importance of a partnered approach to health. Talk to us about some of the initiatives that we'll be reviewing.
Well, first of all, this is, you're asking your question, what the intervention is based on the root causes. This is it.
Yeah.
So the model for this program.
By the way, if Randy doesn't come, he RSVP'd.
Okay. Well, if he doesn't come, he'll say, well, the chairman's there, and then he'll just, he'll get off the hook. He'll show up. He always shows up. But this model of collaboration and mobilization is what we came to around the structural determinants, was the idea that you need communities to make a plan, collaborate, and change. I had a another grant from the NIH for about 15 years, and the whole goal was to get communities together, identify their high priorities, create a strategic plan to make policy changes. So we're going to be looking at mental health. We're going to be looking at asthma.
Diabetes,
obesity, mm-hmm. And there's another one, which I forget.
But all youth-based.
They are youth and children's based, but they are pretty predominantly, they're all pediatric, put it that way.
Will you be showcasing some research, or is it more of a community conversation?
I think it's a community conversation. The way I understand it,
right?
Because I wasn't involved in the planning.
Right.
They just tell me to show up and talk.
Right.
So I do that.
Yeah. No 3D presentation or anything.
Not yet. Not virtual reality. But the model of care, and I have, is based on the idea of they've identified. So for each of those different areas, there's four or five strategic goals that they've identified, some of which are very much looking at like at policies that need to be changed. And my assumption is what they're doing is they're presenting them and thinking about ways to start mobilizing around making those policy changes. All this stuff that I feel, I mean, I very strong, it gets back to your communication. If you continue the communication and persist and have a, I'll call it a sort of theoretical framework for keeping it going, with the idea that you change norms, and then the norms both change individual and also support individual change of attitudes over time, there's no question that somehow, whether that's intentional or not, has an impact. Our whole impact about gay marriage, same-sex marriage, has changed, and it's changed over time. So it is possible to change norms. It just is very difficult in a individualized settings with one sort of bullet to get people to change what they do.
Bullet aside, though, if you think about all of the forums and workshops you're a part of, are you seeing some, you know, all roads lead to Rome? Are you seeing some consistent topics repeated again and again, whether that's poverty eradication, whether that's racism? Are you seeing some big keywords that we should be focusing on?
The big ones are employment,
jobs.
Jobs.
And i.e. then poverty eradication, i.e. then better mental stability.
I think the availability of jobs and the development of a workforce that can take those jobs is probably the essential step in sowing to reduce inequities that we're seeing. And if you can reduce those inequities, there will be, you know, then you'll start having better health consequences. You'll see a lot of things. But the fact, without the existence of jobs.
And good paying jobs. So if you remember the city of St. Pete, their economic report out, job growth is happening, but the wages continue to be suppressed. So even if you have available jobs, you have many, you know, community constituents working several just to make ends
meet. Absolutely. But then you have to decide what, you know, certain things get monetized different than other things. You know, even if you said, I'm going to give someone a living wage, it's hard to have enough living wage jobs in the city.
So then back up a step. So is then education
before
jobs?
No, jobs are the outcome. No, that's where education becomes important.
Is there a step before education?
What you do in terms of early parenting.
And then before that, healthy birth. Non-drug addicted birth. I'm trying to get to the root cause.
Well, but you can only, right, but there's a moment you stop. I mean, I appreciate the point, but it's actually a really important point. Is it where do you stop the why?
Well, it's
a very good point.
It's a very good point, and we're having the same, and it all has merit. So you have educators in the room, you have nonprofits in the room, you have those that are committed to academic advancement.
You have to do it all at once because you can't wait.
That's going to be the name of the campaign.
Yeah, you can't wait. If you look at the Harlem Children's Zone project.
And so they took a concentrated block or two, and then they—
Region, yeah.
They launched—
They gave them everything.
Everything.
And they got a lot of money because they were the only one of its kind. They got a lot of money.
Right.
But now it's 20 years later.
They didn't scale.
Well, it's hard to scale. I mean, I've been involved with different projects where we've tried to scale. And the problem is resources.
Right.
It's just very expensive. I mean, what you can do is at each way boost a little bit on each way, which would be the alternative, which is to say, let's make sure we have healthy babies. Let's make sure that
they go to preschool.
We have preschool that's available to everyone. Then you say, okay, then let's make sure we have a pipeline for getting kids into college, but let's not start the pipeline in 10th grade. Let's start the pipeline in 6th grade. And let's start orienting 6th graders to getting back to your consequence op thing is get them start oriented 6th grade. So then you work on a program that goes 6th to 8th grade.
And while we're in education, do you find our community as invested in education as much as other communities you've been a part of? So Baltimore being an example.
No, Baltimore is horrible schools.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So, okay.
If you want a good education in Baltimore, unless you live in like the one simple enclave that has a great charter, where the parents have taken control of the school, you basically have to send your kid to private school.
So objectively, would you say that we are a community invested in public education?
More so than Baltimore.
That's not a selling point.
I think the commitment is pretty there. I just don't know if we're pulling it off.
Why do you think?
I don't know enough to know. I mean, I like Greco. I mean, I like what's happening.
I think it's our taxpayers. They're not interested.
Well, nobody cares about kids.
If you go to Massachusetts, if you go to New Jersey, you have some communities.
To me, that's some, but affluent communities usually. Go to Newark. It's not happening. I mean, it's, you know.
And this is where I come back to beat the information horse yet again.
Go for it, because we haven't beat it enough.
I'm going to beat it. Because you talk about, you know, in the 50s, you never see a gay person on TV. And now you can't have a sitcom without a gay person or a hit sitcom. And there's a reason for that. There was some journey that happened, right? And there were people that marched in the streets. There were people that got the right kind of jobs in Hollywood. But at some point, there were also advertisers who decided to support the programs and so on and so forth. So you can look at that process and say that it just happened. But I think that there are...
No, I wasn't implying. I was agreeing with you. I was saying, but it takes time. The problem with it as a public health strategy is that you never have that long-term stick-to-itiveness that comes from a movement.
And are you talking about the information for those policymakers and those that execute on solutions, or are you talking about information of the constituencies that are impacted?
Ultimately, I'm talking about seeding an intellectual perspective that can go out and be executed upon. So you look at immigration, right? Immigration, a lot of people have a lot of opinions about it, and it's become it's a national topic, and that's driven by, you know, certain publicity by politicians, by groups. And so if you can do that, if every average American can have an opinion about immigration, you'd think, you know, they could have an opinion about kids' health.
What you're saying, I agree with.
I might suggest that we are processing and distilling that information, though. I don't think it's a lack of information. If you look at even the effort.
Yeah, no, I think what we got to off of this, to beat this thing to death.
No, bring us back home.
Okay, because there's a different question. We were talking about HIV, and we were talking about whether you could get behavior change through communication devices. And I was arguing that most of those campaigns have not worked. The only time they've ever been effective is when everyone was dying and they were scared to death. Second point you're making, which I happen to agree with, which is that over a period of time, we do see norms get changed. And they are due to a multiplicity of factors happening, including communication and amplification, which is your point about ideas. So the idea that you're communicating, putting a fine point on ideas, articulating ideas that are perhaps not as well described, but you bring thought to it, you bring thought to someone else's voice. All those things matter over time, and it works in that context, which says, do we believe the public discourse is good and can help improve society? And I do believe that. That's different than just...
I would say, is there an X factor, another skill or another job, another role that is to be the communication glue between these different entities? So
I'm going to suggest one, okay. And we've talked about it before, but I'm going to suggest that we have very competent entities that can get involved on a very systemic level to eradicate issues before they are even created. I don't think we have a system to plug them all in interdependently, governed by the same metrics, governed by the same process.
It's talking points that I'm talking about, though. It's like you look at the Republican Party. I
think we're full of talking points.
I disagree. I think that if you look at, you know, you watch the talk shows that make fun of the sort of cohesiveness of the Republican message, and they'll show 75 different local news channels, all owned by the same people, or all 75 different Republicans talking, they're saying the exact same thing. So there's a strategy in place that dictates the message. It dictates the distribution of that message. And, you know, I feel like you have these meetings that are coming up where you're going to have these talented people running these different organizations, and they're going to come with their unique perspectives, and they're all going to go in or enact change because of it, which is all a good thing, which ultimately moves the foundation and the norms. But I think perhaps, is there a missing skill set in there, which is
it's called leadership. I mean, I know what you're trying to get to, but it's leadership. And whether you do it as talking points, whether you do it as
execution,
cohesiveness, though, and where does the leadership come from?
Leadership creates cohesiveness. I mean, that's
what I say, that governing, if there was a governing entity that could say, this is what you are proficient in, this is the role you can play in this interdependent framework to get us to point, you know, B. And I can say that to another entity, and that's certainly, communication has a role in that. But I think that the conversation, the talking points, the buy-in even to what we're talking about is there. I think it's understanding how we all-
Leadership isn't one person. I don't mean that there is a leader. I mean that there is distributed leadership with a vision. So two things, one is there's a vision.
But there has to be a cohesiveness to that vision. And then by definition,
there has to be a vision.
But there has to be a something that renews the cohesiveness and keeps the vision alive. Because if you have that meeting and Dr. Tomlin goes and, you know, brings in 1,000 new jobs or 2,000 new jobs, but, you know, the schools do this or do something different, and you guys
that's
go a different way.
Interdependent.
And that's where, you know, the whole, I guess you call it the whole supply chain of being a human from birth to going older.
That's why somebody has to be accountable for, and that's where the leadership comes in. I mean, leadership is accountable. So the idea is that you've got Sylvia can tell you, everything we do as a leadership team is to make sure that everything aligns and focuses. We got a 25-
Under your umbrella, though, which is one specific area,
tell you, it's a pretty complicated system that we monitor. And when I say leadership, it's the fact that we have 10 people, 12 people with a vision. Mm-hmm. We constantly restate the vision. No, I'm just talking about in our hospital, in our health system. I mean, I'm looking back here, but it's pretty complicated.
I don't doubt that. But
No.
But you're not bringing jobs to St. Pete, right?
No, but let me say something to you. When I think about the complications of what we're trying to do in the hospital, and having done community work for, like I said, 20, 30, 40 years, they're all just as complicated. Mm-hmm. The difference I have is I have resources to pay for leaders. That's the biggest difference, because they can stay on task and they can help go with the vision. And the vision, and we do all work on the vision, but I can afford, because there's a return on investment over the period of time. It gets back to my whole point. If you stay on anything long enough with right leadership, you'll get some change.
I think about I'm going to take it back to opioids.
Okay, opiates. If you want opiates, you can have them.
Okay, so that example about the weaning of the baby off and weaning, and then the support for the mother. So if I'm a nonprofit and my mission is to get women clean and to get them their lives back in order, and I've been operating at full tilt, I'm bought into, you know, my vision, which I believe others shared, but then you create a framework for me to plug in exactly what I'm doing, to scale it, to join forces with other entities that will take care of the baby, that will take care of the family, that will have education handled, and you're able to give us all a cohesive, unified roadmap, measure, you know, determinants of success, measurables. I think that that's what's lacking. So if you look at our execution, there's a lot of bumping into one another. There's a lot of redundancy. We're all speaking the same language, but it's not plugged in.
Well, think about the FBI, the CIA, and NSA, and everybody else. They can't even get, I mean, every time there's a report about a failure in intelligence, it's because the CIA, FBI, and NSA won't talk to each other. I mean, it's not an unusual thing that you have people with similar job descriptions bumping into each other for turf reasons, because they have leaders who are more interested in leading their business than they are about the outcome.
So the new type of leader that you loud, what do they have in terms of their own characteristics that isn't that sort of proprietary?
I think there has to be a selflessness, a certain amount of selflessness. There has to be a drive for whatever the outcome is. They have to feel passion for it. We've been interviewing people for so many jobs that Sylvia and I have this conversation, I think, on a, you know, there's a certain amount of ambition that becomes passion, but it can't be so much that it's about them. Mm. They have vision. I believe in a distributive leadership model so that they don't rely on them being the center or the charismatic leader. My biggest worry in my whole life is that I would be a charismatic leader. And I failed in that when I've done it. I mean, it hadn't, nothing bad has
happened. What does that mean?
A charismatic leader.
Oh, I know what that means, but how did you fail?
Oh, because at the end, it all depends on you. And so if you don't do something, or if you don't move it along, if you leave, it goes away. I think a generally distributed leadership model is a better model. It gets back to your point.
Sure, yep.
I mean, it gets back to your idea that you need collaboration.
But my point is that it doesn't matter, because no matter how great or how selfless the leaders are in Johns Hopkins, they're still contained to Johns Hopkins. And I think that we've looked, you know, there's too many mature, you know, the school system is still the school system. The city is still the city. The hospital is still the hospital. And I think the missing X factor is the cohesive spread of that message in a way that can be, that can at the very least accelerate the change that happens over time, because there's a skill to that. But where I end up is that you can never make it a top down. I think it has to be a messaging platform that everybody can be part of without it being a top down authoritarian thing. So people are always trying to bring in the one organization to rule them all.
We talked about you being the face of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. And in take one, our interview with you, you illuminated our listeners as to that development and what it meant for you and your career. You could do us the justice of telling that story. And I believe you have identified phases of your evolution.
I don't even remember them.
But
I remember
transformative phase and the evolution phase.
Yeah, yeah. Transformative.
The transformative. Oh, evolution. Right. I got it.
Wow. Wait. So
I make stuff up as I go along.
And just for reference, I had the opportunity to listen to you share the story at an earlier point, and you talked about, you were very transparent about sort of the grueling nature of this type of merger, and most importantly, the years that follow all of the acclaim and all of the...
Yeah. So what we got to, I don't remember where you heard this, but
I think our technology cut off right in the middle of it.
Okay. So I did start with that. Okay. So the story basically is in the 2000s, 7, 8, the trustees of Johns Hopkins All Children's, or All Children's at the time, recognized they needed to supplement their academic partnership that they had with USF with another institution that they thought could push them towards a level of excellence that would allow them to be a ranked hospital in the country. And whether they were completely aware of how Johns Hopkins could help them do that or not, they did have, getting back to selflessness, the selflessness to say, we will give our hospital and our assets to Johns Hopkins with the promise, and it's nothing more than a promise, that they will do everything within their power to elevate the quality of our care and to enrich the academics of the institution. And over the next, from 2011, when the deal was completed, actually it was yesterday, 7 years ago yesterday.
What's the actual date?
April 1st, 2011.
Wow. There are three things I could say to that.
Okay, well, it was real. It wasn't a joke. And then the next 5 years was really about the first level of foundation building, about creating leadership, a high-level leadership that were able to transmit the ideals of a Johns Hopkins hospital and a Johns Hopkins University system. And when we had that in place and we had the quality metrics and we were driving towards quality in place, Johns Hopkins and the community here both thought, the community here started asking, why are we not just Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital? Because we had been All Children's Hospital, a member of Johns Hopkins. There's Johns Hopkins University, there's Johns Hopkins Hospital and Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. And everybody else who's affiliated with Johns Hopkins or the hospitals are just their name of the hospital as a member. And we were a member, but it was determined, the community was like, why aren't you changing our name to Johns Hopkins? We want to be Johns Hopkins. And then when we took the idea to Baltimore, they said, well, your quality's there and your faculty are there at the high level. And we believe that you will continue and sustain yourself as a Johns Hopkins quality institution. Then when they walk in the door, they say, we want Johns Hopkins quality care. We want Johns Hopkins quality academics. They'll get it here. That was in 2016, April 1st, 2016, that the name got changed. So 5 years later. Now you go around, and this is the part you were talking about. Now becomes the grind, because the simple, you know, do 2-3 years, everyone pats you on the back because it's very ostensible, it's very tangible what changes you're making, because you're going from nothing to something.
Yeah, the visuals.
Yeah, it's very easy. Right. But as you go from something to something more, and it was once said, getting back to your friend Jobs, Steve, there was an argument made that Steve Jobs actually was not that creative, that he went to Xerox PARC and he stole every idea that he had that made the GUI interface look different than anyone else's. But what the argument is that just some people go from nothing to something, but other people take something and take it to something else. And that we always laud the nothing to something, but the something to something else, great, it should also be lauded. And there's a level of creativity in that. And we are at the stage where you're going from something, which we've achieved and was there before we got there, added to it, but it's something. And there's something else. And the problem is that's a much more behind the scenes, much more less it pop, as you said, sort of it doesn't get the fireworks. And a lot of it is just ground game. And during that ground game, you've got to keep people focused, because in some ways you're actually doing more disruption in the classic sense than you were in the beginning. In the beginning, you just put a new coat of paint on.
Yeah.
And as you got to this later stage, you're now actually going into the guts and ripping things apart, and with hoping that you've built a strong enough structure or infrastructure around it that it can take the vibrations when they happen. But you don't have that same, you now are really getting at the heart of a lot of things. And what you hope, again, is that you've built the resiliency into the organization to tolerate it, because it's not as exciting, because it's a lot smaller and finer work. It doesn't come with big flashy appointments. It's really basic blocking and tackling. Big things like making sure your faculty and staff are very engaged, making sure that there's a culture of safety, that people feel everything you said is necessary, the vision, everyone has the vision. There's collaboration, the care models are efficient and effective. You get paid for what you do and you bill for what you do, and you don't bill for stuff you don't do, and you don't not get paid for stuff you do. So, I mean, all kinds of things have to get worked out. And then you go out and recruit people who are at the next level down, whether they're scientists or nurses or physicians, and hope you can get them in and get them on board and get them acclimated to your culture or part of your culture.
Your transitional culture too.
And all that is, so that was the phase two. Phase one was what happened from the time we closed the deal till 2016. And phase two, which we called transformation, we transformed it from a sort of known as a community hospital to a academic, and now it's a, we're in evolution as we evolve that concept.
That was arguably more poignant than your first go-round, so I'm actually glad that we got back in recording. So I want to talk about, you referenced job interviews and you referenced bringing candidates in and what you're looking for. So you probably had, I don't want to imagine what your interview process looked like becoming the man in charge of this entity. What do you remember about that interview process?
Well, I was in Baltimore, and they needed somebody to be the content expert on the transaction. I had come down here in 2008. Then I came again in 2010. And in 2010, I started working on the transaction. And when the transaction closed, I was the basically chief academic officer. I was the vice dean.
Did you think it was going to be temporary? Or
initially it was, and then it was going to be a little less temporary. And then it was, okay, it's not so temporary anymore as we were completing the deal. Because if you look at drafts, it was like, it was interim. Interim, then it stopped being interim, and then it became, there was, you know, I forget what the next step was. But, and then when the decision was made to consider me for the CEO position, given all the factors they wanted, someone who was at Hopkins, who knew their place, who knew academics, who knew hospital administration, it was me.
There was no competition.
Well, wait a second. So then what they did, they didn't want to be accused of making a mistake. So they went and they interviewed 75 people. They did a 360 on me with 75 people.
Did you have any say on who?
No. They basically found everybody who did healthcare or ran a university in this region. They went to Baltimore and looked for everyone I've ever trained or talked to. They went to all my supervisors in Baltimore and all the students I've had and basically interviewed them all and asked them.
Did they share that with you? So now you know who's dead to you and who's
No, I have your no idea. I have no idea what they heard. I don't. I have no
but
idea.
But you knew that they were going through the process.
Yeah. It was killing me. Yeah.
Oh, how long was it?
It took about 3 months.
Worth it.
Was it worth it?
I have a sort of a personal question. Are you a stoic? And the reason I ask you that is because if you are.
Not even close.
Can we lead with that? I would like to lead with that question. So if you think about I don't even know what to describe it, if it's a resilience or it's maybe even just cognitive dissonance, or it's just true empathy and true connection to the work that you do. But having toured All Children's to look at the mission and to understand the foundation a little bit better, it's a little bit of a punch in the gut when you see some of these families and these babies and these young children so ill. And I heard a story about some of the construction work that was happening outside the hospital. And I heard that every Friday there was a dance party, essentially construction workers to entertain the children, stopped what they were doing, blared some music and danced and entertained the kids as they moved into the weekend off duty. And I think about just having to continuously infuse your operations with, you know, a certain amount of levity and hope. So I would assume that somebody who's governing all that does have some level of...
Well, kids, see, most of the people have gone to pediatrics and not adults because kids are resilient. And the belief in their resilience and the joy that you see, and, you know, we have an incredible marketing department that reminds us of the joy and shows us the moments of great spirit that kids have. And it makes it's a lot different than working with older people. I believe it's much harder to deal with old people who are dying. And a lot of the kids get better. A lot of the kids we take care of get better.
Right.
Even the really sick ones get better. And they have spirit to the end too. So they take care of you.
You mentioned the transformative phase and moving into the evolutionary phase. And I kind of feel like St. Pete is going through that a bit now. I feel like we've enjoyed calling what we have here something special is happening, calling it a renaissance. And, you know, I feel also that we're at the point where we need to transition that renaissance into maybe the evolution phase. And you've been here through most of that in the time you've been here. Can you talk a little bit about, in working with a lot of the key leaders in St. Pete, what you've seen happening and what might need to happen?
I'm laughing because I think I never thought of it until this second, and you're absolutely right. I think where we are is tipping over from, boy, this, we have a buzz. We've created a buzz. We have lots of institutions that are, you know, two museums opening up. We have our research building opening up. We have growth in USF St. Pete campus. We have companies moving here. Jabil's doing well. And we have branded ourselves, if you will, sort of getting the name change concept. And you're right. Now where comes the heavy pieces and the key to get everybody engaged, which is, I think, a key element of our transformative phase for the hospital is going to be key. And that's, you know, maybe that's what you've been trying to spit out for the last half an hour. But it is the point is that we do need to get everybody on message, engaged, and understand the plan. I think our meeting, I'm going to try to tie every one of our conversations together. I think our meeting with the community meeting tomorrow is an attempt to start bringing those folks together. The work that the Healthy St. Pete is doing is trying to bring those folks together. What's important is that no one get left behind, because it will put a drag on the system if it doesn't. So part of the transformative action is what you've been sort of pushing for, which is we need to get all elements now aligned and working together. Whereas before, we just needed the top elements. We needed the infrastructure, the big things. You know, we needed buildings. We needed the right government, you know, right mayor. We needed the restaurants to open. You needed the stuff that's sort of high level stuff. And now you got to get down to the guts. So you're right. It's a great analogy.
Not to refer to another guest that we had, but Craig Scherer was talking about the need in this transformative phase of our growth to not be too granular in our approach. And he's definitely a fan of more regional, even broader scale and collaboration. So one of the things, one of the hindrances to that, as he saw it, was really the caliber of leadership that are now evolving to the level of, I guess, a C-suite exec internally in the city. Outside of Johns Hopkins, certainly not commenting on the leaders that you recruited.
He said that there was a lack of them. He didn't see where the next Tom Jameses were going to come from in that lot.
Or the next John Ellen.
I'm more hopeful than him. I think, I mean, Craig is...
He was one of the 75 that was probably interviewed.
Oh, Craig was doing the interviewing for the 75. Craig was one of the interviewers of the 75.
Was he really?
Yeah.
All of the stars aligned.
Oh, my God. He was one of the people that was doing the interviewing. I do think there is a
bench.
No, I think to get into his consciousness, it's much harder now. As much as he is still a city treasurer, and I still consider him a mentor of mine, he's not as engaged just on a daily basis with the people that you all see. And so I'm actually much more hopeful than, I mean, I could do leadership St. Pete, and I look at the, I'm going to call them kids.
Thank you. Okay. Class of 2017.
I know, that's what I'm saying. They're kids.
Baby.
But they're going to emerge in places and make an impact. I think the harder part is what made Tom unique is Tom, because of his business and because of his personality, reached across the bay. And this is probably more to the point. There aren't a lot of people who have that inspiration that he has seen to reach across the bay.
Or broader.
The whole reason the thing with the fountain got to be was an attempt to create something that created collaboration across the bay. Particularly, that's why Judy Lissy from Straz and Hank and me and Gary got together. It was more, the overall goal was to create a dialogue that spread across and ideas. Hopkins has its own innovation hub in Baltimore, and the head of that innovation hub is going to be coming down here this week, I think, actually. Vinick just hired a person to run his hub.
Innovation?
Yeah. His innovation hub. And so we have...
How many innovation hubs?
Lakshmi. I can't remember.
It was in the paper today.
Yeah.
So she's in the paper. And she came from Chicago. So I'm having her and him and I have breakfast next week. I mean, the different opportunities we can to create connections across the bay, that's what I think Craig... Because Craig, when he talks about regional stuff... Because remember, he was part owner of the hockey team, right? Wasn't he for a brief period of time with...
Lightning.
The Lightning.
The Lightning or the Rays.
No, Lightning, but it was, who am I thinking of? The guy who was his partner in that, Ashley Furniture. Not Ashley, Canes. Canes.
Oh, Rothman.
Yeah, but who's
Erwin
the... Erwin Nowak, yeah. So the point was those guys sort of rallied as a regional group and sort of said, okay, we'll keep them. So that's what he's, I think, referring to more than he is that there's not local leadership.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You made it to the end of another great episode. For show notes, head to stpete.co to the show notes page, which includes links to all the resources mentioned in the show, as well as quotes and key insights from the show and information about the guest and the host. Thanks again to our sponsor, Big C. Head to Big C, that's BIGSEA.co to check out their work. And if you like what you heard, make sure to share this episode on social media and leave a comment. See you next time.